Imagine for a second that you are completely stripped of everything that makes you who you are.
Right. Like everything.
Yeah, I mean everything. Your physical body is entirely changed. Your social status is just erased overnight.
Oh, wow.
And your entire society is suddenly miles away, totally inaccessible. You find yourself forced to survive at the absolute bottom of this hostile, feral hierarchy.
It's terrifying to even think about.
Right. How would you hold on to your humanity? Would you just adapt to the brutality, or would you find a way to fight back with whatever, fragments of your old self you had left?
It's really the ultimate stress test of identity. I mean, when all those external markers of who we think we are get violently stripped away, we're forced to see what actually remains underneath.
And that is the exact scenario we are diving into today. So, welcome to the Deep Dive.
Glad to be here.
Our mission today is to explore a truly fascinating, just deeply layered set of session logs from an online fantasy role-playing campaign.
Yeah, and these logs were originally chronicled way back in 2001 and 2002.
Right. And before you wonder why we're looking at a, 25-year-old game transcript,
Yeah.
think about the medium itself. Tabletop and online role-playing games are pure, unscripted, collaborative storytelling.
Exactly. Players are forced to react to trauma and crisis.
And moral dilemmas.
Yes, in real time.
Yeah.
It creates this incredibly authentic window into human psychology.
Because the improvisational nature of it means they can't perfectly curate their reactions.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. When a character is pushed to the brink, the emotions and the defense mechanisms that come out are often astonishingly raw and real.
Which brings us to the focus of today's deep dive,
Yeah.
a fey knight named Redmayne.
Right.
And for a little context, when we say fey, we're talking about immortal, magical beings who are deeply tied to nature and like a high fantasy nobility.
Very structured, very proud.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And through Redmayne's incredibly intense journey, we are going to examine profound themes of identity, the clash between civilized structure and wild instinct, and this is a big one, the devastating societal cost of forgotten history.
For sure.
Okay, let's unpack this. Where does Redmayne's plunge into the wild actually begin?
Well, the catalyst happens in a ruined ancient city called Lunafell. Redmayne has been captured by a massive pack of wolves.
But these aren't just, ordinary animals roaming the woods.
No, not at all. They are a complex, desperate society calling themselves the Children of Ceridwen.
Right.
Their numbers are dwindling, so they've resorted to capturing fey people and using this ancient brutal magic to forcibly transform them into wolves just to bolster their ranks.
And they justify this as a necessary evil, right? Like, they believe they are preserving their culture against their great enemy, the Fey Lord of December.
Exactly.
But Redmayne, being a proud knight, is absolutely refusing to go quietly. She is standing in the center of this ruined cathedral, surrounded by the wolf elders, and she tries to prove to them that what they are doing is an absolute blasphemy against their own goddess, Ceridwen.
Right, she draws her sword.
Yeah, she draws her consecrated sword. It's this incredible steel blade named Morrigan the Crone, dedicated to the goddess of death. And she strikes it directly into a giant granite crescent moon carved into the cathedral floor.
And the result of that strike is incredibly dramatic. I mean, the blade hits the stone with the deafening sound of thunder.
It's just a massive shockwave.
Yeah, setting up a huge shower of sparks,
Yeah.
and it completely shatters the solid granite moon.
Wow.
In the context of their religion, it is an undeniable physical omen that the goddess disapproves of this forced conversion.
But the elders' reaction to this undeniable proof is what, sets the tragedy in motion. They completely ignore the omen. That is wild to me. The stone literally shatters and they just shrug it off.
They do, and it highlights a terrifying psychological mechanism, really, ideological entrenchment.
Right.
These elders are so consumed by their desperation and their fear of cultural extinction that their worldview has become impenetrable.
They just can't see anything else.
Exactly. No amount of divine proof, no physical miracle will sway them because admitting they are wrong would mean admitting their decades of kidnapping and torture were unjustified.
They need the Fae to be the enemy to justify their own atrocities.
Precisely.
So since the elders refuse to listen to reason or divine intervention, we get to one of the most visceral, intense scenes in the entire chronicle.
It is brutal.
Redmayne realizes she has lost. She submits to the transformation, she is forced to strip, and the magic takes hold, turning her into a wolf.
Yeah, and the logs do not shy away from the sheer agonizing body horror of this.
Not at all. It isn't a magical sparkle. It's brutal. She feels her spine literally twisting and flexing upward.
Her bones are snapping and realigning.
Yes. Her fingers bend unnaturally backward and crackle as they fuse into paws.
And we have to remember, the baseline for her pain tolerance is already astronomical. She compares this transformation to her past battles in a place called the Undying Lands.
Oh, right. Let me give a little context on that. The Undying Lands in this lore is a gruesome realm of eternal warfare, where combatants are burned, impaled, and shot with arrows.
But they are magically prevented from dying.
Exactly. So they just suffer endlessly.
Right. And Redmayne is saying that turning into a wolf hurts just as much, if not more, than that perpetual torture. That's the staggering level of physical trauma she is enduring.
Her ribcage collapses inward. Black and red fur erupts from her skin. And on top of the physical pain, her senses are completely overwhelmed by a terrifying flood of new, hypersensitive scents and sounds.
It's an absolute nightmare.
It really is. But here is the kicker. When she finally wakes up in this new, terrifying body, she's immediately categorized by the pack as an Omega.
The lowest of the low.
Right. That is the absolute lowest, most abused punching bag rank in their feral hierarchy. But does she submit? No. She instantly starts plotting.
The pivot is immediate. I mean, she finds allies right away. She connects with her friend Ertzabet.
The Ertzabet is great.
She is. She's a higher-ranking wolf who actually makes the massive sacrifice of giving up her own social status to formally adopt Redmayne as a pup, just to offer her some legal protection within the pack.
That's huge.
And she also allies with a mysterious, heavily bandaged wolf named Thomas.
And Redmayne's plan here is brilliant. I kind of view this like someone getting unfairly demoted from a cushy executive suite all the way down to the mailroom.
Oh, I love that analogy.
Right. And instead of quitting or crying in the corner, they immediately start secretly unionizing the mailroom workers to overthrow the toxic management upstairs.
That's exactly what it is.
She tells Thomas she wants to bring civilization to the pack. She wants to organize the weak Omegas to publicly humiliate a high-ranking bully named Angriff to prove that the feral hierarchy is a sham.
But we really need to look at the psychology driving that unionization. You know, Redmayne's sudden obsession with building civilization isn't just a tactical move. It's a massive psychological defense mechanism.
How so?
Well, she is terrified of losing her fey identity to the animalistic instincts flooding her new brain. She explicitly states in the logs, "I will not shed civilization. I have fought too hard to leave behind the animal in me."
Wow.
She is clinging to the structured knightly ideal of protecting the weak because it serves as a mental life raft. It's the only anchor keeping her tethered to her former self while her new body is screaming at her to just submit to the law of the jungle.
That profound tension between her disciplined fey mind and her wild wolf body really hits a boiling point the next morning.
Yeah, reality sets in hard.
It really does. She wakes up with Thomas literally drooling in her fur.
Yeah.
She's trying to eat hard-cured rabbit jerky without hands.
Just awkwardly and frustratingly pinning it down with her paws and tearing at it.
Exactly. And then Ertzabet takes them out into the deep forest for a training run.
And the contrast during this run highlights how disconnected Redmayne is from her physical form. I mean, she is clumsy.
Yeah, complaining about her paws bleeding on the rocks.
Right. She's overthinking how to leap over fallen logs. Meanwhile, Thomas is completely in tune with his environment. He's bounding effortlessly, zigzagging up steep, rocky inclines, literally rebounding off tree trunks.
He makes it look so easy.
He does, because he's trying to demonstrate that her struggles aren't because the body is weak, but because her mind is actively fighting her own muscles.
But the real test, the moment that truly breaks her, is when Ertzabet forces them to hunt a live deer.
This scene is so intense.
It really is. Thomas expertly flushes the deer out of the brush, driving it right toward Ertzabet, who leaps out and makes a brutal, lethal kill, crushing the deer's throat.
Very violent.
Extremely violent and bloody. And Redmayne just watches from a distance, completely paralyzed with terror. But she isn't terrified of the dead deer. She is terrified of herself.
Because the scent of the hot blood causes her wolf nostrils to flare, and her body instinctively craves it.
Yes.
She breaks down and confesses to Thomas that she is terrified of her own bloodlust. She reveals that back when she was in the Undying Lands, she was what she calls a monster.
A monster, right.
When she felt powerless, she used the act of killing as a psychological escape. She became an addict to battlefield violence. She is terrified that if she gives an inch to these new wolf instincts, she won't just be a wolf. She'll relapse into being a rabid, mindless killer.
And this is where Thomas gives her some very philosophical advice. He tells her not to fight the instincts, but to ride the river of life.
Right.
He argues that true power isn't taking life, it's giving it, and that she needs to accept this wild part of herself rather than exhausting all her energy trying to dam up the river.
It's profound advice.
But I have to push back on Thomas here. Is riding the river really good advice for someone dealing with severe PTSD?
I can see why you'd say that.
I mean, she just told him she's a recovering addict of violence. Telling her to just embrace the feral instinct feels a bit like telling someone who is terrified of heights to just jump out of an airplane without a parachute and see how the wind feels.
It definitely sounds reckless on the surface. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, especially through the lens of Jungian psychology, Thomas isn't giving her generic, toxic positivity advice.
Okay, walk me through that.
To use your airplane metaphor, it's more like realizing she was already violently pushed out of the airplane years ago when she was traumatized in the Undying Lands.
Oh, I see.
She's been in free fall ever since, eyes squeezed shut, rigid with fear, just hoping she doesn't hit the ground. Thomas is telling her she has to open her eyes, look at the ground rushing up at her, and start weaving a parachute out of the very wind she's terrified of.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. He's telling her to grab the steering wheel, not lock herself in the trunk.
Precisely. Carl Jung wrote extensively about the shadow, the dark, repressed, instinctual parts of our psyche. By blindly suppressing her violent past and treating her feral instincts as an enemy, Red Mane is actually giving them total power over her.
Because whatever you resist persists.
Exactly. The more you push the shadow into the dark, the denser and more explosive it becomes. Thomas understands that you can't conquer the beast by ignoring it. You have to integrate it.
You have to ride the edge of that instinct.
Yes, always maintaining awareness so you control it rather than it controlling you.
Because they realize the Wolf Elders will never change their ways, and Redmane needs to figure out how to survive, their immediate priority becomes finding an escape route from this toxic society.
And the only way out seems to be pushing deeper into the unknown.
Right. While they are in the ruins of the town, Redmane notices a crucial detail. The tight iron collars all the wolves are forced to wear. She recognizes the metalwork. They are dwarven made.
Such a great detail.
She theorizes that if there are ancient dwarven ruins nearby, there might be a key or an underground tunnel leading out of the valley. So Erzsébet leads her and Thomas down into these ancient, dark, subterranean caves.
And the shift in atmosphere as they go underground is palpable on the logs. The harsh sunlight of the feral world fades away completely.
It gets really eerie.
Very. They find themselves walking through grand tunnels, bathing in this incredibly soft, eerie green light emanating from bioluminescent moss, twisting along the stone ceiling. And it's here, in this quiet, forgotten place, that they unearth a piece of history that completely shatters everything they thought they knew.
They stumble upon a massive, ancient mural painted onto the stone walls. It's primitive, but the narrative it depicts is unmistakable.
What does it show?
It shows the very first contact between the Fae and the wolves. The painting shows a wolf being attacked by a terrifying shadow monster, and out of nowhere, a Fae man steps in, fights off the monster, and saves the wolf.
Wow!
He then nurses the wolf back to health, and the two of them become inseparable companions.
The mural then depicts them standing together before a statue of the wolf goddess, Ceridwen. And through some lingering ancient magic in the cave, the mural actually begins to animate.
Oh, that's so cool.
The painted stone literally moves. The goddess blesses the Fae man and the wolf because they have proven that the refined world of the Fae and the primal world of the wild don't have to be at war. They can unite.
And here's where it gets really interesting. The goddess transforms them so they can walk in both worlds.
Right.
The wolf is granted the ability to become a Fae woman, and the Fae man is granted the ability to become a wolf. And when the magical image zooms in on their Fae faces, the man looks exactly like the regal current Fae Lord of December.
And the woman.
She looks exactly like their friend Erzsébet.
It is a staggering piece of lore. The Fae man and the wolf became the very first Lord and Lady of December.
Mind-blowing.
The entire foundation of this region, the origin of these two warring species, was built on a literal love story between a Fae and a wolf. Thomas, who mentioned earlier that he is actually of mixed noble blood himself.
Descended from both House November and House February.
Right. Exactly. He points out the immense, devastating tragedy of what they are looking at.
The irony is almost painful. When you have the current pack of wolves kidnapping Fae, torturing them, and forcibly transforming them into wolves to preserve their culture against the Lord of December.
Yeah.
They are completely unaware that their own revered founder, the original Lady of December, was a wolf who loved a fae.
And on the flip side, the current Lord of December is waging a ruthless war against the wolves, completely forgetting that his own ancestor was a fae who loved a wolf.
It's so tragic.
They are slaughtering each other over a racial divide that literally did not exist at their genesis.
This brings up a fascinating sociological mechanism regarding how societies actively erase their own history, doesn't it?
It really does. The current factions haven't just accidentally misplaced this mural.
Right.
Over generations, leaders like the Wolf Elders and the current Lord of December have allowed prejudice and isolation to bury this truth because their power depends on it.
Because peace doesn't require strict hierarchies, but war does.
Exactly. If the Wolf Elders admitted that their holy founder loved a fae, their entire justification for kidnapping and forced conversions collapses. Their authority evaporates.
So true.
Societal forgetting isn't usually an accident. It is the passive-aggressive starvation of inconvenient truths. As Thomas solemnly notes in the cave, even memory is lost in time.
Such a powerful line.
The leaders have built their entire identities around being enemies. Acknowledging they are actually family would completely destabilize the world order they control.
It shows how easily the truth gets buried by whatever the current anger or fear dictates. But speaking of anger and fear, transitioning from how a society erases its history, we are about to see how an individual confronts theirs.
Yeah, this next part is heavy.
Because the only way forward is deeper into the dark. They leave the glowing moss behind, and the environment drastically changes.
They step out of the magical caves into a ruined, sprawling, dwarven great hall. The eerie green light is completely gone.
So it's just pitch black.
Pitch black, choked with dust, littered with broken arrows, and covered in the rusting armor and skeletal remains of hundreds of dwarves and fae warriors.
The moment they step into this graveyard, Thomas's entire demeanor changes. His hackles rise, he goes completely rigid, his ears flatten, and he refuses to make eye contact with Redmayne.
He's terrified.
Right. And Redmayne is highly perceptive. She looks at him, looks at the bones, and realizes Thomas didn't just stumble upon this place. He knows the layout. She asks him directly if he fought in the battle that left all these skeletons.
And Thomas's confession in this dusty hall is chilling. He doesn't look at her when he says it. He replies, "I didn't just fight in this battle, I caused it."
Wow.
He goes on to explain that centuries ago, the dwarves and the fae were locked in a brutal cycle of endless revenge killings. During one of those raids, the dwarves murdered someone Thomas loved deeply. Consumed by total blinding grief and anger, Thomas didn't just track down the warriors responsible. He tracked their families here to this underground sanctuary to make them feel the exact pain he felt. His actions triggered an absolute massacre.
I really want you to visualize that for a second. Imagine having to physically walk through the crunching skeletal remains of the absolute worst mistake of your entire life.
It's unthinkable.
The literal physical evidence of your deepest regret, your greatest shame, just lying there in the dust beneath your feet. How does a person even begin to process that level of guilt? Most people would run away. They would absolutely refuse to look at it.
But Thomas chooses not to run. He forces himself to stand there and look at the bones. He uses this horrific moment to teach Redmayne one final lesson.
Which is?
He tells her that this massacre is the exact reason his current philosophy in life is what it is. He spends his life exploring, trying to understand different cultures, and guiding lost people like Redmayne.
Oh, to make up for it.
Right. He does it to ensure he never allows his shadow to take control like that again. He admits it doesn't undo the murders he committed, but it gives his horrific past a purpose. It is the ultimate form of shadow integration.
He manages to locate an underground river at the far end of the hall, complete with old dwarven boats, which provides them with their escape route. But before they leave, Thomas pauses.
Yeah.
He says that someday, when it is safe, he wants to come back down into the dark to properly bury the bones he is responsible for. And Redmayne, who has spent this entire deep dive completely guarded, obsessed with her own trauma and her own survival, steps out of her shell.
It's a huge turning point for her.
It really is. She immediately offers to help him. She says she wants to be there to dig the graves simply because she is his friend. It is a really beautiful moment that cements their bond.
It acts as a perfect thematic synthesis for everything we've discussed. Look at the incredible duality between these two characters.
Right. They mirror each other.
Exactly. Redmayne is desperately trying to build civilization to control her inner anger, terrified that she might become a monster. Thomas, on the other hand, literally destroyed a civilization because he let his anger take the wheel.
Such a contrast.
He is living with the guilt of the beast he already was. They are two sides of the exact same coin. By leaning on each other, they are learning how to navigate the darkness without letting it consume them.
So bring this all back to the surface. What does this mean for us? We've gone on quite the journey today.
We really have.
We started with Redmayne's brutal, agonizing physical transformation into a wolf, losing everything that defined her. We followed her through the psychological trial of the hunt where she had to face her own addiction to violence.
Right.
We walked into those glowing caves and unearthed the historical revelation that proved an entire generations-long war was based on a suppressed truth. And we ended with Thomas's sobering lesson among the bones of his victims, highlighting the absolute cyclical futility of revenge.
The overarching through-line connecting all these events is incredibly clear. Whether you were looking at the Wolf Elders forcing iron collars onto innocent captives out of fear of extinction, or Lord December waging an endless war, or Thomas causing a massacre out of blinding grief, or even Redmayne rigidly clinging to the rules of knighthood, every single one of these actions is a desperate reaction to fear.
Because we all have those animal instincts inside of us.
Yeah, crazy.
We all feel irrational anger. We all feel deep-seated fear. We all have that petty, burning desire for revenge when someone wrongs us.
Absolutely.
The takeaway from these logs isn't about judging whether or not we have those instincts. It's about what we choose to do with them. Do we let our fear build walls? Do we let our anger forge iron collars to control the people around us?
Or do we, like Thomas is attempting to do now, take our darkest experiences and use them to protect the vulnerable and seek genuine understanding? And it ultimately comes back to the power and the danger of memory. That ancient mural in the cave serves as a warning for all of us. When we allow ourselves to forget our shared humanity, or in their case, their shared fae and wolf origins, we lose our moral compass. We become capable of truly monstrous things simply because we forgot that the person standing across the ideological battlefield is actually our kin.
Which brings us to a final thought I want to leave you with today. We talked at the very beginning about being stripped of everything and surviving in a hostile world.
Yeah.
The Fae and the Wolves in this story are literally slaughtering each other, locking each other in collars, and destroying their world purely because they forgot a beautiful love story that happened generations ago. They forgot their own shared roots.
It's completely tragic.
So I want you to think about your own life. Think about the broader world around us right now. What conflicts in your own world, or even in your own personal relationships, only exist today because someone, somewhere, simply forgot how they used to be connected?
That's a great question to reflect on.
Until next time, keep diving deep.